Thank you, everybody, for coming to number two in our series on Great Debates in Jewish History. The idea that I had originally was that this was going to be a four-part series. We'll see if we keep to that. The first one we did was a debate in Tanakh. We were discussing the merits and the debate over the monarchy in Shmuel Aleph Perek Chet. Here we're going to discuss a debate from Chazal, and the next two that I have in mind was to do something kind of like structured like the Zionism Shiurim, where we're going to do something from the medieval period and then something from the modern Jewish history. That being said, this is going to be the last of the Great Debate series for a minute. It's going to be on hiatus for the next 3 weeks. We're going to shift into a three-part series on Megillat Esther. So I'm going to do, I think if we spend three whole Shiurim on Megillat Esther, we could do a really good close reading of it. And in preparation for Purim, I think that it is a good opportunity. And hopefully after Purim, Bezrat Hashem, at some point, we might, whether it's immediately after Purim or we wait until after Pesach, we'll get back to this topic. Because after Purim, I'm thinking we might do something in the Haggadah. But for now, we're going to continue, of course, with Volume 2 of the Great Debate Series. So I titled this, Of the People or For the People, right? Except for Judah and Myra, who I just was discussing this with. You know, what's the reference from? I just said, except for Judah. Yeah, it's from the Gettysburg Address. But very good turn of phrase. But the point, of course, is, of the people and for the people, is, am I acting on behalf of the, are the people that we're talking about, are they supposed to be of the people? Or is the goal supposed to be that it's not necessarily of the people, that they are just, that they are a select and elite, but this select elite is meant to act on behalf of the people? Admission standards and the Tanaitic dispute over the ivory tower. So we're going to get to really only a couple of lines that comes up in a much longer story about Rabbi Gamliel in the Gemara Masechet Brachot. That's going to be the crux of what we're going to discuss today. But it's really part of a much larger larger discussion. It's much more of a much larger story. The one line that he has about the admission standards, about the about who he was going to accept into the yeshiva in Yavne. Before we can get to that, though, I thought that it's really important, and I think that there's really no way to understand this, I think, well. I think that if you don't understand the historical context in which this debate happened, you can't appreciate exactly what was going on. So the first section over here is just a little bit of a background. We are now in the period after Churban Bayit Sheni. 70 CE, the Romans, who had had control, as we discussed in one of the Zionism Shiurim, they had control for well over a century over the over what they called Syria, what they called the province of Syria, which eventually Syria was Judea. There was two different components to it. So during the period of Roman rule, that was when the Tanaim began to flourish. First the Zugot, and then the Tanaim. And then, of course, when it came to the tragic climax of the rule of Roman rule in 70 CE, when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, the story of Masechet Gittin, which we actually read together in one of the Shiurim, was where the discussion was taking place with Vespasian in order to spare the wise people of Yavne, and the yeshiva basically began to flourish from that point on. Until that point, until the year 70, the center of Torah Judaism, the center of the Sanhedrin, of Torah learning throughout the Jewish world, was in Yerushalayim. It was in the Beit HaMikdash. After the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the great effort that was made was to basically maintain that center of Torah, of Rabbinic Judaism, but shift it somewhere else, in a place that wasn't a political capital, so that if the Judaism as a political entity wasn't going to be able to survive in the immediate future, at the very least, the Torah could. Of course, a pivotal decision. We spoke about it the last time that we were when we spoke about it in the Zionism Shiurim. So, just a quick overview of this history, and I'm going to do it by way of the chain of tradition of Rabbinic Judaism as outlined in Pirkei Avot. So take a look at these years, 170 to BCE to 140 to BCE. Okay, again, keep in mind that the critical date here is 70 CE, which is 200 years after this point that we're beginning. This is the period of the leadership of the Zugot. Right? If we spoke about this last time, Shimon HaTzadik, who was in the Shiarei Knesset HaGedola, That was the beginning of the Sukkot. Was with his Talmidim. Until then, the Anshe Knesset HaGadola reigned supreme, and they did for the entire period of Bayit Sheni, which was a period of over 300 years. And now we're shifting into the period of the Sukkot. The Sukkot were the first names that are mentioned in the Mishnah historically. They were, for all intents and purposes, the first Tanaim. So the period of leadership of Yossi ben Yoezer as the Nasi, and Yossi ben Yochanan as the head of the court. So the Nasi and the Av Beit Din were basically the president and the vice president of the religious Jewish leadership. So the Nasi of the Sanhedrin was the head. The Av Beit Din was basically his second in command. So the Zugot, throughout this period, were comprised most of the time of these two figureheads. And you recognize these names from Pirkei Avot. Yossi ben Yoezer of Tzreda, and Yossi ben Yochanan of Yerushalayim, that was 170 to 140. 140 to 100 was the period of Yoshua ben Parachia and Itai Arbeli. When we get to then 100 to 60 was the period of Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach. 60 to 30 is Shemaiah Naphtalion. All right, and then once we get to 30 to 10, which is probably the most critical period of the Zugot, that's when we get to Hillel and Shammai. Now, Hillel and Shammai were fierce interlocutors, but in their lifetime, they were members of the same rabbinic body. After their passing, it shifts no longer into Hillel HaZaken and Shammai HaZaken, but what is the new entities that came about after their passing? Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. They came into two separate academies. And anybody who's learned even a small amount of literature in Chazal know that these two academies were bitter rivals, and they represented two opposing views, two opposing philosophies in so many different areas. Not only of halachic interpretation, but of philosophical outlook, of ideology, of Jewish philosophy in general. They were very, very distinct, these two. And it was bitter, the dispute between the two of them. And if you look at when Hillel and Shammai lived, and then when the immediate aftermath of their passing was, this is probably one of the most critical periods of Jewish history, ever. So Hillel and Shammai were not only the leaders, the great Torah sages and leaders that they were, when they were, but the fraction that happened, the split between these two camps immediately afterwards, was happening at a time when Jewish leadership, Jewish sovereignty was ebbing away eventually to its ultimate demise. So that was the period of Hillel and Shammai. Again, if you're looking for just dates here, 37 to BCE to 4 BCE was when Herod started. Okay, now you can't understand the history of this context without understanding who Herod was and when he lived. Herod was an interesting figure in the way Chazal depict him. He was who Herod was. Hurdus, who Hurdus was, as he's referred to in the Gemara. Hurdus was a governor that was a vassal governor of Rome. Rome, which had now conquered the entire area, the way they would do it is how the empire worked. They would conquer the area, they would establish sovereignty there, and in order to do that, they would take a Roman general, a Roman figure, and they would install them as the political leader there. So they did. So that's who Herod was, and he came along and he had grand ideas. He was enamored of the Jewish people and of Eretz Israel. And we don't have time to get into his history right now, but his period of rule, which one of his grandest projects was what? Beis HaMikdash. He had a mass renovation project. 400 years the Beis HaMikdash was around, and it was less than magnificent. And then he came along, and one of his greatest, he had a ton of building projects throughout Eretz Israel, but one of his greatest ones was the Beit HaMikdash. So Herod is there. He dies in 4 BC. Now it's important to recognize, take a look at the map here. The red perimeter over here, the red line, represents the Malchus, or the leadership, the area, the government of Hurdus, of Herod. After he died, Rome, trying to control things because there was a lot of unrest going on, they split this up into various different places. Now we're going to speak, we'll refer back to this map, but we're going to speak about how Yerushalayim was originally the center, and we went to Yavne. Yavne on this map is called Yamnia. It's a little blurry. Can you see where it is? It's on the top of the blue. See? So what do you notice about the difference between Yerushalayim and Yavne on this map? What's distinct? The different colors are representing the post-Herod divisions of this piece of land. What's starkly noticeable? They're in two different colors. All right, Yavne actually wasn't a different. We're talking about the division of this land. Yavne wasn't a different govern it. It was in a different place of rule. So if we're talking, a big part of this shift historically involved the political leadership of the Jewish people. They were politically autonomous, then they were politically dependent, but still to a degree politically autonomous, and then their political autonomy was completely destroyed, but they still had political clout. And part of that was basically getting out of the center and moving into a different jurisdiction, so to speak. Okay, so we'll get back to that. Herod lived 37 to BC to 4 BC. 4 BC, the land gets split up, and now it's in different jurisdictions. And then now 10 CE to 30 CE is the leadership of Shimon ben Hillel, the son of Hillel. He was the Nasi. And then 30 to 50 CE is the period of Gamliel HaZaken. Gamliel HaZaken is the grandfather of Rabban Gamliel that we are going to be meeting. His son Rabban Shimon Gamliel succeeded him in the period of in 50 to 70 C. Rabban Shimon Gamliel is the Nasi at the time of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And again, just as a point of reference, 66 to 73 is the Bar Kokhba revolt, which happened basically through the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And then 70, of course, is the destruction of the Bayit Sheni. And then now we get to that. The shift happens, right, as the Gemara in Gittin describes. Shift happens from Yerushalayim to Yavneh. And during that period, the first of the Nisi'im, of the head of the Sanhedrin, as it shifted to Yavneh, was who? Gamliel, Rabban Gamliel. The famous Rabban Gamliel that we are so familiar with from the Gemara, from the Mishnah and the Gemara, all over the place. That was the Rabban Gamliel who was the first Nasi of Yavneh, the first Nasi of the Sanhedrin post the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Now, again, the reason that I'm taking time to do this is because I really don't think you can appreciate any decision, any political decision, any public policy decision, and really anything that Rabbi Gamliel is making and that Rabbi Gamliel is saying or that Rabbi Gamliel is advocating without appreciating what was going on in this history. This was the most tumultuous moment, it's definitely up there in the top two or three. One of the most greatest moments of crisis in the history of the Jewish people. And Rabbi Gamliel is now the head of the Jewish people at the time of this crisis. Yeah.
No, it's just because the Romans are going to take over Jerusalem, and the Beit HaMikdash is the
before. Right? The Beit HaMikdash has now been destroyed.
It's destroyed.
It's gone. It's tumultuous because the entire structure of Judaism is gone. Right? It existed with Yerushalayim at its center. There was sacrifice. The mitzvot are dependent on sovereign rule, sovereign life in Eretz Yisrael. We no longer have that sovereign life, and not only that, but we also have a government that does not care about the Jews very much. Think about, again, I put the Bar Kokhba revolt in there for a reason. What happened with the Bar Kokhba revolt? Bar Kokhba was later. I'm sorry. This is the first Jewish Roman revolt. Thank you very much, Michael, for correcting me. Bar Kokhba happened about 100 years later, in 130, I think. It was the first Jewish Roman war. That was the thank you. So it was the revolt that was going on during this 6-year period, which is what led the Jewish people to. It's what led the Rome to bring down the iron fist onto Bnei Israel, onto Judea, and to take complete control over it. Now the reason why that was going on is because of this difficult situation. So now Rabbi Gamliel takes charge at this point in history when there was so much uncertainty going on. All right. So again, I don't think you can appreciate what's going on here unless you realize and recognize that. Now, halachically speaking, I don't think that we need to constantly be looking at every opinion of Rabbi Gamliel and saying, how do we square this historically? I do think that when it comes to... there's a difference. I think that you can ask that, and I think that it's not always going to be irrelevant to the conversation. But I do think that when it comes to policy, when it comes to public policy, when it comes to decisions about educational philosophy, those are things that are unquestionably influenced by Torah Shebaal Peh, are unquestionably influenced by Mesorah. But I also think that those are questions that you need to square with the historical context in which they're taking place. Does anybody disagree with me? Because we can. I don't think that there's a clear answer to that question. I think that when push comes to all I'm saying is that it's part of the evaluation of the when you're evaluating the situation, you have to understand it. Okay. That being said, so let's take a look at who Rabbi Gamliel was. in light of this period in history, Rabbi Gamliel did some, at this point, did some very significant things. Now, most of these things, when the Gemara is describing them, it doesn't say, by the way, he did this, and he was also the first of the halachic in Torah leadership post Bayit Sheni. You have to piece these things together, but it's really not that. Once you know that basic point about Rabbi Gamliel, you can understand what's going on. Tefillah minolan. The Gemara, we're in source number one here. From where do we have tefillah from? Right, this is the Gemara in Brachot. The Tanya, the Braitha teaches Shimon Apkuli, his dear Shmona Esrei Brachot, Lifnei Rabban Gamliel al Haseder BeYavne. One of the things that Rabbi Gamliel, that is attributed to Rabbi Gamliel, that Rabbi Gamliel instituted, is the Shmona Esrei as we know it today. The Gemara goes on to say about how originally there was 18 Brachot, and then because of so much sectarian disputes within Bnei Israel, It was such a difficult time that he even instituted a 19th bracha, and Rabbi Gamliel was behind that effort. So, point number one, if you want to appreciate what gave Judaism the form that it has today, Rabbi Gamliel is probably one of the most important figures. There was formal tefillah already from the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, but the form of the Shemoneh Esrei that we have today, this is Rabbi Gamliel was behind it. Okay, so tefillah. Take a look at source number two. Rabbi Gamliel Omer, "V'chol yom v'yom mitpalel adam shmona esrei." Rabbi Yeshua Omer, "Me'ein shmona esrei." Rabbi Kiva Omer, "Im shgura tefillah d'befiv mitpalel shmona esrei." The imlav, "Me'ein shmona esrei." So same idea. This is a four-way machloket in the Mishnah Brachot. The point is that not only was he instituting the text of the tefillah, but he was instituting the daily process of actually davening. So daily prayer was clearly on the agenda in Yavne at the very early stages. Okay, so and Rabbi Gamliel, who was the head of the yeshiva, was unquestionably behind it. Okay, a couple of other things that I just want to there are the number of Mamarei Chazal about Rabbi Gamliel that we can put here are too numerous. So I took a small selection, and I just took a small selection. The Tanya, all right, we're in the Gemara and Masechet Sota. Misaper komi hari zeh midarkei amori. That translation is not right. That's from something else. So there was a certain type of haircut that was wrong. Okay, you weren't allowed to have it was a gaisha haircut. That's basically what the Gemara is saying. You're not allowed to have a gaisha haircut. That was considered dakei amori. Aftolos ben Reuven hitiru l'saper komi, but Aftolos ben Reuven was somebody who was allowed to have this haircut. I wasn't looking at you. Shehu Karov L'Malchut. Why was this guy, Apollos Ben Reuven, allowed to have this type of haircut? Because he was Karov L'Malchus. Appreciate for a second what's going on here, the importance and the need to have people that were in the upper, in the upper ranks and able to talk to, you know, the foreign governments. This is something that has been relevant now, basically for the last 2,000 years, that we've needed Jews who are not only, you know, good people and committed to our religion, but also people who are able to, you know, talk the talk and walk the walk of the political leadership that has control over, Jewish people. So that's why, even though it's considered Darkei Amori, it's for Aftolos ben Reuven, it was okay. And that is the immediate forerunner. So the next line of the Gemara, Shel Beit Rabban Gamliel hitiru lehen chachma yevanit. Rabbi Gamliel's, not just Rabbi Gamliel, but Rabbi Gamliel's family, his home, that Greek wisdom was permitted in his family. All right, Torah Mad, Torah V'Chachma, philosophy, call it what you will, but the reason why is for the same reason. Now, we're not getting into this discussion of Greek wisdom. It's a much larger discussion than this. But anybody who says that it is unquestionably, unreservedly endorsed by Chazal doesn't know much Chazal. It's something that Chazal are very much struggle with, and there are many places where Chazal endorse it very much and recognize the value to it, but almost always with the caveat that it's not something that we can, you know, just allow, you know, carte blanche. So Rabbi Gamliel's family, it says of him that not only was he the great leader, not only did he institute daily institutions like the Shmona Esrei, but he also was somebody who was very learned in secular knowledge. And not only that, but this Gemara makes explicit reference to the fact that he not only was a halachic leader, a rabbinic leader, but he was a political leader as well. All right? And there's several Mamari Chazal about this. There's a number of Midrashim and a number of Gemaras in the Yerushalmi and the Bavli also, about how he used to take these boat trips to Rome to speak to the Roman emperor on behalf of the Jewish people. He went on diplomatic missions. That he was the far, he was not only the, and you think about it, he was not only the Rosh Yeshiva in Yavne then, he was also the Jewish people's foreign minister. That's a lot of responsibility for one person. But Rabbi Gamliel was that person. Okay, a couple of other institutions. Again, there's no rhyme or reason to these. I just picked a few that we're familiar with. The Gemara, source number 4, Rabbi Gamliel haya omer, kosh lo omer shlosh dvarim elu bepesach lo yatsa yidei chavato, ve'elohein pesach matzo omar. What does that mean? Give me like the broad interpretation of what that means. Yes, it means that anybody who doesn't discuss Pesach Matzah Omar is not Yotzei Yischolo. What mitzvah are we talking about? Nope. Not what is he? There is no mitzvah Yitzia Mitzrayim. Sibur Yitzia Mitzrayim is the mitzvah that we have on the Lal Seder. Rabbi Gamliel instituted. What does it mean? Kol Shelo Omar Shlosha Dvarim. What does that mean? What does it mean to speak? Relate the story, to talk about it. All right? Does that sound similar to what we do L'El Seder? Rabbi Gamliel, I think that this is abundantly clear. Rabbi Gamliel not only instituted Shemona Esrei, he initiated the entire concept of the Haggadah, of a formalized text, of a formalized curriculum that needs to be discussed at L'El Seder. Okay? These are, again, the tefillah, this type of thing, these are just like bedrocks of Jewish practice that exist still today, which Rabbi Gamliel, we take for granted, but Rabbi Gamliel initiated them.
Well, because he's taking us away from a Beis HaMikdash-centric Judaism to the one that we have today. So we had to institute certain things that were not habitual at the time, but would maintain the kinds of relationships that the Jewish people had.
I couldn't agree more. I think that it was consciously on his mind that he needs to refashion Judaism, basically. And I think that a second part of this, which is what I'm getting at, is that Rabbi Gamliel not only needed to refashion Judaism for the ages, for a time in which the Beit HaMikdash was not centric, he also needed to refashion Judaism for a time in which Jews were not going to be as knowledgeable and not going to be as connected to people who were as knowledgeable. This is why you need formalized text. This is why you need, things that are set. Look at the, I glossed over it, but this is actually the dissenting opinion, the last dissenting opinion, in source number 2. Right? What's the main complaint that everybody always says about davening? So same text, 3 times a day. What do people say about it? Too much talking. What's the second thing that everybody always says about davening? What did everybody say? What's the big challenge with our high school kids? It's too what? Repetitive. It's meaningless. It's empty. It's devoid of depth. What we're reading the same. Imagine being forced to get up and read the same 5 pages of Shakespeare 3 times a day every single day for your entire life. How at a certain point it loses its meaning. That is not what I'm saying. That is what the standard trope finding tefillah difficult. And it's true. Look at the last dissenting opinion, Rabbi Eliezer, in source number 2. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, ha'osa tefillah so keva? Somebody who makes tefillah repetitive, daily, continuous, every single day, ain't tefillato tachanunim. It's not real. He's never going to be genuine in his tefillah. Now, do you think that Rabbi Gamliel didn't acknowledge that? He didn't recognize that? He didn't see that there could be some significant degree of monotony to instituting tefillah Shemona Esrei, the same text every single day? What do you think? Do you think that he disagreed on this point? That no, nobody's going to find this monotonous. Same 5 pages of Shakespeare every day, everybody's going to love it. I think it's a fair bet that he understood the potential for monotony. Why did he do it anyway? Why did he institute davening tefillah anyway? Yeah. Okay. So one of the issues is unity. Like we needed some sort of central text to actually unify the people. And anybody else?
Carbonos were monotonous.
Yeah, but carbonos were not required of the individual person every single day. And now I'll give you one more. Was it the same Kohen every single day that was doing the carbon? No, there was a rotation of people. So even that example is not monotonous in terms of that. It's monotonous in the sense that it's the same deed being done every day, but it's not the same person doing the same deed. So yes, on one hand is Jewish unity, but give me another, very quickly, come on, give me another explanation. Why is it necessary, despite the fact that it's potentially monotonous, why was it important to do?
Practice makes perfect. If you do something three times a day, every day, you're going to elevate yourself, period.
You'd say the words well, but it would still be monotonous and not be something.
People were illiterate, and it was the only way they could remember.
Yeah. Okay. So the same text is because we need to. We needed to. That's kind of what I'm getting at. You have a point, Rabbi? Oh, I thought I saw your hand. Yes, people were becoming less knowledgeable. I think that because of people becoming less knowledgeable, we needed a central text that they could remember, even if they didn't understand it, which is obviously resonant for us today. But it was also important that they had a central text that they could associate with. It's not just a question of unity. It's not even just a question of something that they could memorize, even if their language was challenged. They needed a central text because it was for the first time they were threatened to. They were very much. The threat was very much real that Judaism was going to fall away, and without something central, then there was nothing to cling to. So I think Rabbi Gamliel probably would have said to his dissenter here, "Yes, I acknowledge that it would probably be monotonous, but that's a price that we're going to have to pay." Yeah, ideally, tefillah should be, and it's also you know, it represents a goal and an ideal that we can strive for in every single day to make that meaningful. But despite the monotony, despite the potential for monotony, and even he would probably argue, even despite the inevitability of the monotony, because it's impossible that we can have an entire people find davening meaningful three times a day. I still think, and this is how we hold halakhically, I still think that it needs to be done because this is how we're going to keep people, you know, in the fold. Okay. Good, yeah. Keva, yeah.
Don't make it feel rogue.
Absolutely. I mean, the argument here in the Mishnah, the first thing was about the text. The first source that I gave was about the text. This one was about the routine of tefillah, right? When it's instituted. So, yeah, right. I agree. Okay. So, last source, also just very interesting about the character of Rav Gamliel, we're on source number 5. Kishamei Tevi Avdo. Tevi was the slave of Rav Gamliel. There are a fascinating concept. There's several halachot that we learn from Rav Gamliel's treatment of his slave Tevi and Tevi himself, who is lauded in Chazal for being a sage and a devoted servant and somebody who Rabbi Gamliel held in the highest of esteem. Ad kidei kach, that if you see in North Star 75, Kishamei Tevi Avdo, when Tevi died, the slave of Rabbi Gamliel, Kibel alav tanchumen, he accepted nechama, he sat Shiva for his own slave. Amr lo talmidav, Lamadatein Rabbeinu, you taught us she'ein mekablin tanchumen al avadim. His student said, "You said that you don't sit shiva for a slave." Amar lahem, he said, "Ein tevi avdi kishar kol avadim. My servant Tevi is not like all other slaves. Kasher haya, he was a good guy. Kasher haya, we can debate what exactly that means, but there was something about his slave that was so significant that it was deserving of." Now, this is not a policy point. I think this is a much more of a personality thing with Rabbi Gamliel. He was somebody that acknowledged, you know, that had relationships and felt things, and he, to a certain extent, I think this is kind of saying that he was an iconoclast to some extent. This was an accepted halachic position that he espoused to his students, and he was saying, no, even that, there are exceptions to. So I would call this nuance, I would call it complexity, I would call it depth. Rabbi Gamliel, it is abundantly clear, not only was he a great leader, not only was he probably one of the most important people in Jewish history, but he was a person of wide-ranging knowledge, and I would argue emotional depth as well. Okay, now all of this is, I think, very much not only an appreciation of the character of Rabbi Gamliel, but I think, but also very much to his lauding his character and his personality. Now, the reason that I started with this is because my first exposure to Rabbi Gamliel, which I imagine I'm not the only one here, for the first time that we all learned Gemara. Did you guys learn the fourth parak of Brachos? That was my first Gemara. Well, Elam Tzias. Elam Tzias is another popular choice. Anybody else learn Tzias Hashachar first? Michael, next year you're going to come up and teach Elam Tzias, okay? So Tzias Hashachar, the fourth parak of Brachos, was in North Shore where I went to school. This was the first parak. I think it's probably a better choice than Elam Tzias, but I don't know if I were making the choices if I would have picked this one. Be that as it may, my first exposure to Rabbi Gamliel as a person is from the following story. I want to read through it. Again, I want to talk. I want to discuss admission standards and the ivory tower. But I want to do it by way of this because I think it says a lot about the character of Rabbi Gamliel, the context, the historical context in which he was working, and what eventually happened. Tanur Rabbanan. We're in source number 6 here. Maaseh b'talmud echad sheba lifnei Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yoshua, who was the second in command. Amar lo, he said to Rabbi Yoshua, Tfilat arvit reshut ochova. This is the fourth chapter of Brachot is dealing with tefillah. That was where one of the other quotes that we had up there was from. Is the tefillah of Maariv, or of Arvit, is it a reshut, or is it a chova? Is it obligatory, or is it optional? Amar lo, reshut. Rabbi Yoshua said to him, it's optional. Ba lifnei Rabbi Gamliel. They then asked Rabbi Gamliel, who was the boss, he was the head. Amar lo, tefillat arvit reshut ochova. They asked him, and Amar lo, chova. He said it was a chova. Amar lo, halo Rabbi Yoshua, amar li reshut. All right, so I don't think the Talmidim here, I don't think get enough of enough of the criticism in this story, because there seems to have been some a little bit of manipulating here. I don't know, once they got the answer from Rabbi Yeshua, they needed to go ask Rabbi Gamliel, and once they got the answer from Rabbi Gamliel, why they needed to like foment this dispute. Okay, but we're talking about Talmidim in Yavne, and especially considering, I'll point this out, this is why I think the point that I just made, I was being cute, but the point is why this is relevant, is because we're going to see in a few minutes, in a couple of minutes when we get to the bottom of the source, what the standards were for having people come into the Beit Midrash. Rabbi Gamliel must have held these two guys that were asking him in the highest of esteem. Yet, despite that, they were doing this. So they either had a really good reason to foment this this dispute, or Rabbi Gamliel maybe missed his own criteria on admission standards. I don't know, but considering what we know eventually about the admission standards, I don't think that this point can go unnoticed. Okay, Amar lo, Hamtein. What did Rabbi Gamliel said to the student that spoke to him? Hamtein ad shi kansu baalei trisin lebeit hamidrash. Wait until the shield bearers enter the Beit HaMidrash. All right, the catchphrase. Rashi says it was just the Talmidim. Like, wait until this can be a more public debate. Because if it's just between the four of us, I don't want to do it. What is a shield bearer? So literally, it just means a person that holds a shield. It's a poetic way of referring to somebody who's like a defender of the Torah. Yeah. So basically, this was just a poetic way of saying wait until everybody comes. Right, the fact that in this context they're called shield bearers, I think, is important. Because Rabbi Gamliel clearly has got an agenda, as we'll see in a second. Well, he had a plan about how he was going to deal with the situation. And he wanted the people who he believed to be defending the faith, defenders of halacha, defenders of rabbinic Judaism, he wanted them at the time. But again, I'm interpreting. All this on the surface means is that wait till everybody gets here. When the shield bearers came, Amar Ashoel the Shoel, the guy who asked the question originally, asked again. Filas Aravis Rishus Achova. Is it obligatory? Is it optional? Amar Lahem Megamliel Chova. He says it's obligatory. Amar Lahem Megamliel Achachamim. Rabbi Gamliel says to the rest of the people there. Klum Yesh Adam Shecholek Badavarze. I say that it is a Chova. Is there anybody that wants to disagree with me? Amar lo Rabbi Yeshua Lav. Rabbi Yeshua, who again was the proponent of the opinion that different than Rabbi Gamliel previously, said, no, Rabbi Gamliel, everybody agrees with you. You're the boss. Amar lo, Rabbi Gamliel said to him, V'halo, Mishimcha Amar li Rishus. In your name, people told me that you disagree with me. Amar lo, Yeshua, Rabbi Gamliel then continues to talk to him. He says, Yeshua, you, Yeshua, not Rabbi Yehoshua, you, Josh. Amod al raglecha via iduvach. Get up now, stand, and give testimony to the fact that you said differently than me. Now, by the way, also this shouldn't go unnoticed. Who was asked first?
Yeshua.
Rabbi Yeshua was asked first. If the Talmud, based on the way the story is going, if the Talmud had come along and said, Rabbi Gamliel said that the davening ma'arav is a chova, it's obligatory, what do you think Rabbi Yeshua would have responded to? How do you think he would have answered? Yeah, he said, okay, fine, follow Rabbi Gamliel. The whole story gets out of hand here because the Talmud first asked Rabbi Yeshua and then went to Rabbi Gamliel. Also, an important point. So it's coming to light, now that the Baalei Trisin are there, he says, get up and Amar Rabbi Yeshua Raglav, get up and give testimony. So Rabbi Yeshua stood up, Amar, Il Malecha Anichai Behumeis Yachol Achai Lahachish Sameis. Basically, what he's saying is that if Rabbi Gamliel was dead, and the Mefarshim discuss what exactly he's getting at here. But basically, what this means is that if he had the opportunity to lie or to wiggle out of the honest truth here, he would, but he can't because Rabbi Gamliel is here in front of me, demanding that I say exactly what I said, and I have no choice but to do it. Hayar Rabbi Gamliel. All right, so ostensibly, he then got up and did it. Hayar Rabbi Gamliel Yoshev Dorish. So Rabbi Gamliel sat and spoke, and we continued learning. Rabbi Yoshua Omid al Raglav, Rabbi Yoshua stood on his feet. Ad Shirinu Kol. All right, so this is when everybody's had it. Ad Shirinu Kol Am Amru Lachutzpit Aturgaman. Chutzpit, who was the Turgaman? He was the person that they had, who basically, you know, in the days before microphones, when there was a Beit Midrash full of people, so there was one person with a loud voice who was basically in charge of announcing the topic of discussion. Right, so for lack of a better term, he was basically the gabbai. He was the one who was announcing the pages and telling, kind of guiding the entire discussion. So Chutzpit, who was the guy that everybody looked to keep order, they said, stop. He said, what? Amod, stand up, stop what you're doing. The Amad. And he stood. Okay, we're at the beginning of the third paragraph here. Amri. Ad kama nitzari v'nezil. How long are we going to tolerate this distressing of Rabbi Yoshua? There's two previous cases in the Gemara. I encourage you to look them up. They're fascinating instances. Again, getting to the character of Rabbi Gamliel, but this was basically a pattern that he did. He harassed Rabbi Yoshua a lot, and he had a problem with this. To nabre, impeach him. Let's get him out of office. He's no longer going to be the Nasi. Man Nokim Lay, who are we going to put in instead of him? Nokmi Rabbi Yoshua? Can we appoint Rabbi Yoshua? No, we can't do that. Ba'maisahu. Rabbi Yoshua can't replace him because he was the one who was behind this whole episode in the first place. And that's just not going to work. Nokmi Rabbi Akiva? Can we appoint Rabbi Akiva? No, we can't. Why? Dilma Anish Lay, Delet Lay Zechut Avot. Rabbi Akiva, who the Gemara says descended from Gerim, he didn't have the lineage. He didn't have the yichus. So things might happen to him because he doesn't have that. He doesn't have the yichus. Now, it could mean that this is referring to more of a mystical way that he is not going to have the proper mazel. Or it could mean, in the context of this, I actually think this is probably the more likely read. It's because he didn't have those political connections that Rabbi Gamliel did. And if that's the case, if he gets into trouble, which we all know Rabbi Akiva's story, he eventually does. It's not going to be good. We need our leader to be somebody that can politically advocate for us. And Rabbi Akiva is not a good choice. So it can't be him. Ella, we're in the middle of the third paragraph. Nokmi le Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, dehu chacham. We should pick Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah because he is a wise man, hu ashir, he's rich, hu asiri la Ezra, and he's the 10th generation from Ezra Hasofer. Hu chacham. All right, now explains what these three criteria. Hu chacham di'im akshalim mefarakle. Any question you can ask him, he can give you a quick answer. Hu ashir, and he's rich. Why is that important? Di'i itle lafaluch levei kesar afu azal lafalach. If there's any issues with the Caesar, he'll be able to deal with them as well. Hu asiri la Ezra did le zechut avot, because he also has zechut avot v'lo matzei anish le. And since he has the zechut avot, again, either if we're talking about the mystical way or we're talking about the political upper echelon, everybody knows that this is a leader and we're not going to mess with him. Either way, he's not going to, nobody's going to punish him. So we need, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, even though the Gemara goes on, I skipped this part, but the Gemara goes on to say that he was extremely young for the position, we all know from the Haggadah, this is where that Chazal and the Haggadah comes from, is that his beard wasn't white and he looked like a young buck. That nevertheless, because he met the criteria that we needed, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was the guy that we want for the job. Tana. All right. So then the Braita goes on to say that that's what happened. They appointed Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Tana. Ota yom silkuhu l'shomer apetach. What happened that day? They took away the guard from the Beit Midrash. V'nitna lahem reshut l'talmidim l'kanes, and they gave permission for the students in the Beit Midrash, for any students to enter. Shahaya Rabbi Gamliel machriz v'omer, and this is the most important line in terms of our topic. Rabbi Gamliel came along and he said, Kol tamid she'eino tocho kevaro, any student who is inside is not like his outside. Lo yikanes lebeit hamidrash. Any person who is not tocho kevaro, he's not allowed in. What does that mean, tocho kevaro? Good person. Why? What does that mean, a good person? He paid tuition. Toho kavaro, it means, yeah?
Toho kavaro means transparency.
Okay, so I would agree with you. I think it's not, yeah, so I would agree with you that the most important thing here is that a person is real. Is that a person is not putting on a show. He's not a poser. He's not somebody who's trying to be something that they're not. And for Rabbi Gamliel, sincerity, being real, was the most important thing. Now, the way this is usually translated, the way this is usually interpreted, is that, right, we'll get to it, because I want to, that's how I want to frame the discussion. But let's just go read the rest of this, because you have to read how this is just amazing, this whole story. Okay, so we're in the end of the fourth paragraph. The middle of the fourth paragraph. Hahu yoma, on that day, itosve kama safsale. Because now they had all of a sudden let all these people into the Beit Midrash, we had to bring in a lot of benches. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan said, "Pligi ba Abba Yosef ben Dustai for Rabbanan." There was a dispute among Abba Yosef ben Dustai and the Rabbanan. Chad Amar Itosei Arba Me'a Safsale. One person, one of them said, they brought in 400 benches. Chad Amar Shva Me'a Safsale. And one said they brought in 700 benches. Your average bench, let's say, taking our benches, your average bench holds 3-4 people. So, if those are the numbers that we're talking about, then bringing in 400 benches times 4, we're dealing with a significant number of new people that flooded the Beit Midrash that day, and it had a profound effect. Because everybody now is learning. Hava kachal shadaita to Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel now is reacting to this huge influx of talmidim. Hava kachal shadaita to Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel was petrified. He was terrified. He was just terribly depressed. Amar dilma chas v'shalom manati Torah miYisrael. Maybe I withheld Torah from the Jewish people by my policy. I left for 5 minutes, and look what's happening. And then Tana, how does the Gemara end up here? Finish off Tana in the last paragraph. Ediot bo vayom nishnit. What's ediot? Ediot is a masechet of Mishnayot. All right. There was an entire masechet that was written, says the Gemara, says the Brisa, on the day that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, that Rabbi Gamliel was taken away, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah took over. The kol heichad aminan bo bayom, and any time in the Mishnaic literature, in the Tanaic literature, that we have the term bo bayom, ahu yom ahava, it's the day that these 400 or 700 benches were brought in. V'lo hayta halacha shehayta tzluya beveit hamidrash shelo pershua, and there was no halacha. It's a pretty intense statement. There was no halacha on that day that was not explained. And think about who we're talking about here. Rabbi Gamliel, the one who was just impeached, thrown out. Right? He didn't leave, he stayed. He took part in the discussion. And the Brita actually goes on to talk about how he didn't stop his learning. He continued to be one of the interlocutors in a debate of a particular halakha. Okay. It's a pretty crazy story, no? Some of us may have seen it before, some may have not. I think it was just too good to not read it all inside, all the different components. Now, I want to just recap a couple of the important components in terms of understanding our question. Number one, what was going on here? Rabbi Gamliel was the head. We know, we had our little introduction, so we have a little bit of an appreciation over who he was, what he instituted, what he was about, the historical context in which he was operating. We have an idea of the type of jurisdiction that he held over the Beit Midrash. Right, people, I don't know what the motivation of the guy who was asking the question about Tfilat Arvit was, but what I do know is that the outcome of it tells us what type of Rosh Yeshiva Rabbi Gamliel was. He was somebody that demanded absolute and unconditional authority. He was the main man. He was the boss. And if you challenge his authority, even inadvertently, but again, think about who Rabbi Yeshua was, think about how he reacted. I think we all would agree that if Rabbi Yeshua was asked second, he unquestionably wouldn't have challenged his authority. But Rabbi Gamliel was so steadfast in practicing that authority, that's interpretation number one, or he had a problem with Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua, there's something about Rabbi Yeshua that he just couldn't get over, and that's why there were several instances in which he gave him trouble.
Who think Shachris is for Avram and Mincha is for Yitzchak and Arvit?
Yeah, it's all the same sugya in the fourth paragraph of Brachot. Yeah, why?
Because if it was prior to Rabban Gamliel, the asking of Rabbi Gamliel, so the question should be answered already if it was the tikkun was before.
So I don't think that the simple understanding of the Gemara of Avram tikkun tefillah shachrit and Yitzchak tikkun tefillah mincha is that Avram and Yitzchak were, you know, coming to Avram was coming to Vasikin every single morning and putting his tefillin on and you know, saying Psukei Dezimra. I don't think that that's that, you know, that that's too outlandish that I'm saying that. I think that I think the principle, the concept of getting up early in the morning was a character trait that was very much espoused by Avram. I think that the Torah is very clear about that. I think that the idea of, and I also think that I actually spoke about this Friday night a couple of times when we were Sefer Brachos. I think that the different the emphasis in that Gemara probably should be not necessarily on the time, but the type of tefillah that it was. Right, the Gemara, each one of them is a different type. Right, with Avraham, it was they each describe different psukim. Right, what was the pasuk that from the drasha for Avraham? Ashram Avram Baboker. What? Yeah, and now in Amida El Tfila. So Bakom Asher Amad Sham. So in Amida El Tfila. So one is Amida. With Yitzchak, it was Sicha. All right, and with Yaakov, it's around me. Yeah, Vayfka and Pegia El Tfila. Those are three different adjectives, or three different verbs. And I think that my favorite way of reading that Gemara is putting the emphasis on that. There was a different type of way that they approached HaKadosh Baruch Hu, each of them. And that's what we're getting at. But Af Al Pi Chein, it ties it to a certain time of day. So we need to understand that as well. Be that as it may, I don't think that Rabbi Gamliel was taking an institute. He was still instituting something which had textual basis, but it was never a widespread institution. Yeah.
So Rabbi Gamliel is instituting something that has variety. Institutionalized and
centralized,
but has variety.
Well, the Anshei Knesset HaGadol started doing formal tefillah. They just didn't institute the exact text and the exact times. Rabbi Gamliel was coming along and doing that. Okay, I don't want to get bogged down in the tefillah question. I'm more interested in the policy question of Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel is coming along and making this very extreme policy. Okay, so the other thing that we're learning about Rabbi Gamliel here is this admission standard that he had for the Beit Midrash. Anybody who was not Tochel Kavaro was not included in the Beit Midrash. Couldn't come in. They couldn't even audit classes. Right? They weren't allowed in the room. Only people who were Tochel Kavaro. Now I always learned, and if I'm not mistaken, I didn't put on the sheet, but Rashi basically learns this way also. A Tochel Kavaro means that he was a good person. Is that he was a tzaddik. That he was somebody who was righteous and stood for important things.
What you see, it's what you get.
So, I agree that that's probably a good reading also, but we'll get to it. But let's take that first understanding. That means that you're a good guy. Okay, so what? If that's the case, then what is his policy about admission standards? Well, yeah, there's a policy is that only the most righteous of people, only the biggest tzaddikim can be in our yeshiva, can be involved. Now, what was going on in the yeshiva? Our yeshiva today, sometimes we fall into this situation in which we start imagining the yeshiva in Yavna as the yeshiva of today. The yeshiva in Yavna was much more akin to the Supreme Court than it is to our yeshivas. There is no consequence other than the paramount significance of Talmud Torah, which is not to be belittled, but there's no consequence in terms of Jewish life or Jewish history about everybody in the Beit Midrash and Yeshiva University about whether, you know, how well they learned the Tosfos that morning that they're learning. It is a different reason why we're learning there, which is an important one. We can talk about the importance of Talmud Torah another time. Yeshiva and Yavna was not that. They were deciding policy, they were making policy decisions. The word ran out for the entire Jewish people based on what was going on in Yavna. Now, when you think about it like that, again, my first impression of Rabbi Gamliel when I read this when I was in sixth grade was that he was not a very nice guy. And that he was not, right, he was mean. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and Rabbi Yeshua were nice. All right, and that's all there was to it. And we all have had mean teachers before. They might even be really smart. They might even be really learned. But mean teachers are mean teachers, and that's just the end of it. That was my impression of Rabbi Gamliel when I was young. But first of all, I don't think it's true. He sat Shiva for Tevi Avdo. I think there's countless examples of instances in which he was a good, kind, empathetic man. But what do you mean?
He didn't judge people on their intellectual capacity. He was a good person.
Yeah. So for him though, what I would say is he's upholding a standard, and I think that it was what was so important for him was that standard being, that standard being held to unquestionably, unreservedly. I spoke about it a couple of weeks ago. Justice Scalia, of blessed memory, has had a real roshim on me. I discovered the Supreme Court at the same time that I kind of discovered learning Torah Shebal Peh on a advanced level. And Justice Scalia actually has always made a real impression on me because of what the degree to which he espoused his philosophy. It was never about him. It was always about the work. It was always about, a constitutional interpretation. And it never could be about anything having to do with my own opinion. Countless interviews, they would say, how do you feel about abortion? It's like, I'm not telling you how I feel about abortion. How I feel about abortion is completely irrelevant. The only thing that I'm concerned with is what the Constitution says about abortion, which I'm going to go on to say is nothing. And therefore, if you wanted to have a law about abortion, you have to pass a law, and that's out of getting the Supreme Court to rule on it, which is why it doesn't matter. The point is that he adhered to an ideal. One of the lines that he always used to say all the time was he was an elitist in terms of the Supreme Court, and he would say, "What we do here, it's lawyers' work. It's not for journalists, and it's not for your John Q. taxpayer. It's lawyers' work. You need to be an expert in the law in order to do what we're doing. And if that's the case, I'm not interested in having a legal discussion about the decisions that we're making with a novice. It's a waste of my time, and quite frankly, if they were somehow manage to have any influence, it would be a perversion of the system, because only the experts should be involved in this type of work. That's what we do. That's what the Supreme Court's supposed to be. A havdil. I think that this is kind of what Rabbi Gamliel is espousing here also. What we're talking about here, what we're doing, what we are advocating, is not to mean that people shouldn't learn. It's that in the most important center of Torah in the entire world, what's now not only important because it's making halachic decisions, but it is making halachic decisions for all time, as history has borne out, that's not something that we can take lightly. We're not just letting anybody in. So approach number one is to say that Rabbi Gamliel only needed, like Michael was suggesting before, and like I was suggesting as well, approach number one is that we only can have good people. People who are strong of heart, tzaddikim, people who are good, moral, ethical, sincere people. The other way to read it is very different, but I think possibly if you're going to take the words literally, if Tocha Kabaro might even be more accurate. Rabbi Gamliel was not interested in anybody who was putting on a show. He wanted somebody who was absolutely unconditionally sincere. Now you tell me, why is sincerity the most important quality here? What do you think? If what we're saying is true, that we're trying to decide who gets in and actually has a voice and has an opportunity to make points and ask questions vis-a-vis Torah, that's going to be decided for all time. Why is
impartial? You need to have the capability of being impartial.
Okay, so.
Quality.
What do you think, Ari?
I think it means that you have no hidden intentions. If you are what you seem to be, then you're sincere about why you're there. If you're sincere about why you're there, then you can focus on the issue.
Right. I agree. And I think you guys are saying the same thing. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sorry, lahav deal, but I'm gonna frame this in a debate over the Supreme Court also. Justice Scalia, Zichrono Livracha, would have said, if you're coming to the discussion saying that I don't like abortion, or I don't like, pick your issue, whatever it is, I don't like this issue, and I don't like the idea that our law prohibits it or is not unquestionably allowing it. That's something that's going to taint your legal interpretation, because right now what the process that we're going at is interpreting precepts in the Constitution of the United States. What we are not doing is taking our feelings and our proclivities and our opinions and imposing them on a Constitution in a way that the people who wrote that document never meant. That was his entire platform. And he would say that anybody who reads abortion or gay marriage into the Constitution of the United States of America is out of their mind, because in the 18th century there was no abortion and there was no gay marriage. So therefore, it can't possibly be that. Again, I'm oversimplifying a really complicated discussion, and I'm certainly not coming down on a side of this argument. I'm just talking about the process of legal interpretation. That's kind of what's going on here. We need somebody who can divorce themselves, divorce their opinions, their proclivities, their biases from the discussion and make it about legal interpretation. And if that's the case, that's what he liked. Now, let me just make one more point about this Gemara. What was the objection that caused everybody to oust Rabbi Gamliel? Why did they kick him out? Is it because of this strict admission standards that he had? What was the reason?
No, because he had the argument with Rabbi
Yoshua. Yeah, because he was being nasty to Rabbi Yoshua for the third time, and we can't have that anymore. Rabbi Yoshua was one of the great sages of the Jewish people, and we can't handle this person being so nasty. Our leader can't be so nasty. Now, think about it. If Rabbi Gamliel was all about kindness and sincerity and sweetness and being a good person, then I think that objection makes sense in one way. They're saying that you're not holding your own ideals. If we're all about being good people, then we're out of here. Then you can't be our leader. If Rabbi Gamliel was talking about all, it's the most important quality is sincerity, is being real, not being posing or performing in any kind of way, then the fact that their objection was about, more than anything else, being a good person, meant that they were trying to inject a new level of standard that was required.
Yeah,
that's my point. I mean, I think that the Chachamim here were saying it's not enough that we be sincere and we be real. We also need to be good, sensitive, kind people. I'm not saying it's a contradiction. I'm just saying that they're adding a second component to the admission standards. So if that's the case, that's how we read this. Now, the final point in this Gemara is that as soon as Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah takes the reins, this is why, when you read it for the first time, like I said, I read it in a very superficial way. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah takes the reins, and then what's the first thing that he does? He opens the doors and lets everybody in. What does that have to do with anything? He was ousted for being a good person. Now, for not being a good person. The natural outcome of all that, or a simple read of this Gemara, is that the reason why he opened the doors is Rabbi Gamliel kept them out because people weren't good people, or people weren't nice. But that's when we hear that no, his admission standards are all about Tocha Kabaro. So it sounds to me like all of a sudden, if we're reading Tocha Kabaro being one way, that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was now all of a sudden letting people in who were either insincere or not good, not nice. Now, are those people you want in the Beis Medrash?
If you fast forward and you look at the story of Rabbi Akiva, telling him you haven't
Yeah, I wasn't thinking of it, but it's an excellent point. Rabbi Akiva's story of the Gemara Menachot about the 12 Alef Zug Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva that died, Shno Nagu Kavod Zeh Bazeh. But it's an incredible point. What happens when we don't care about, again, either the sincerity or the character of the Talmidim? Everything can fall apart. So let's talk about the good side of this. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah lets things in, and how is it that Masechet Ediyot was written? What does the Braisa say? What took place all of a sudden that hadn't taken place in a while? All of a sudden there were all these new people in there, and there were questions. Okay, so I think if we're talking about educational philosophy, one of the things that this is teaching us is that the more questions and the more debate, the more discussion, regardless of who's having the debate, is a positive thing. Right? The Gemara clearly is coming out in the end saying that this is a good thing that we had all these discussions. Okay, let me stop there in terms of the Gemara. I think that I titled it the debate over the ivory tower. I think it's comical. I don't know if this was why or not, but where does the term ivory tower come from? Source number 7 is a pretty good hint. Shir Shirim. Very good. Thank you, Michael. Shir Shirim. Tzavarech kamidal ashen in the 7th parak. Tzavarech kamidal ashen einayich berechot cheshbechashpon al sha'ar bat rabim apech kamidal halvanon sofe pnei damasek. Your neck, like a tower of ivory. Your eyes, pools in cheshbon. By the gate of the lordly city, your profile is like the tower of Lebanon looking out toward Damascus. Beautiful poetic language. Of course, this is the entire Shir Shirim, which is, a person describing his lover. So the Medrash on Shir Shirim actually describes, and this is just so interesting that this actually, maybe this is where the concept of the ivory tower came from. Tzavarech kamidal ashen, your neck is like an ivory tower. Elu Sanhedrin, the ivory tower, right? Reference to the Lishkat HaGazit, the Sanhedrin, which sat in this chamber of hewn stone. That is a reference to the Sanhedrin, the ivory tower. Your eyes are like pools in Cheshbon. This refers to, right? Elu ha-chachamim kishahim itkansim la'itza ve'in adam yodea mahem yotzim v'adavar nodal rabim. These are the people that are asked a question. They're not sure what the answer is, but people know the answer. Okay. The concept here, I think, is very reflective of the point. The ivory tower that we're discussing is the debate, is the question that we're having of whether or not a person, an educational system should be limited to the elite or not. What's the advantage of having the elite? Debate Midrash, which was effectively the Sanhedrin in Yavne, was the Sanhedrin. I mean, which was an elite institution. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah came along and said, everybody's allowed to come in. And now all of a sudden all these new questions are being asked. But at the same time, we still acknowledge that the Sanhedrin is the elite. So maybe the way to read this is that there's two tiers. Maybe the way to read the Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and the innovation on how to read the Gemara and Brachos was that the pshara in the end was that just because there is an elite, just because there is a higher end class of elite scholars, that doesn't mean that their elite scholarship needs to be removed from the people. It doesn't mean that people, that they need to sit literally in their tower and be away from everybody else. And it doesn't mean that nobody should be able to ask questions and glean from their scholarship. It also possibly means, and again, this is depending on what you mean by Tocho Kabaro, it also might mean that there's a lot to be gained from the Sanhedrin being exposed to the average person. If a person is in the ivory tower and is not part of the people, yet he's the one making decisions on behalf of the people, I think that that's, you know, certainly my favorite way of reading this whole story, is that the principle that the Gemara is advocating in the end is one of, yes, of course, an elite level of scholarship, but one that is sensitive to the people, and not just sensitive, but willing to incorporate the involvement of the people, of the average person, into the discourse. Not just that they are sensitive human beings, but that sensitivity allows them to listen and allow Masechet Idyot to be written. Again, it's not just that they listened. It's that they actually took part in new types of discourse that allowed for new learning to happen. And that was because of that. Very quickly, Rav Lichtenstein said something beautiful about the ivory tower. Take a look at the third paragraph of source number 9. He's talking about, if anybody hasn't seen this, this was an autobiography, a sicha that he gave in yeshiva, just not long ago, shortly before he was nifter, about his own life and the different, vicissitudes of his own life and the thoughts and feelings that he had. To anybody who knew Rav Lichtenstein, this is a must read. So he wanted to help the Jewish people, and he felt that that needed to have some connection to Torah. Third paragraph. At the same time, I didn't want to lead a cloistered Ivy League, ivory-towered life. This is when he was leaving Harvard, he was describing. I knew all about the debate about the ivory tower, and it is a debate which, to some extent, I live with, trying to avoid making a move or making a decision too far in one direction or the other. I try to encompass both elements. I give a shir menachot. Menachot is a masechet in Kudshim that is not typically learned. That is the ivory tower part of me. A wonderful part, which I appreciate and love. So teaching this advanced masechet was Rav Lichtenstein's ivory tower. Still, there is also the need to try and impact upon the communal life as well. There are two ways of doing that. One is to become engaged and involved in communal life directly. And the other is to help build up an institution which will indirectly impact in some way. I do not tell you that at some point I sat down and made a calculation one way or the other. At the very outset, when Harav Amital invited me to join him here, his letter was clear. He wrote me, "You know for yourself what the relationship between the yeshiva world and the non-yeshiva world is like, and what attitudes they have towards each other. Let's go change it." So, for me personally, I was never a Talmud of Rav Amital. I was barely a Talmud of Rav Lichtenstein. But this is a message that really does resonate with me. The acknowledgement, the realization that there is this divide between the yeshiva and the rest of the world, and that mission of trying to change it, feeling the need to go about, bridging that gap and connecting the two. I think that that is really reflective of what the Gemara in Brachot is discussing. Bringing everybody in to have them involved and to have their input be a part of the discourse. Not just because you're a good person, but because you value that and you see that that being part of the discourse is part of what makes the discourse, what makes the end result that much more qualitative. Just to close. So Rabbi Gamliel, like we've been saying, was a very interesting fellow. A couple of stories about him. Let me just end with source 11. Tan Rabbanan, Meimot Moshe V'Yad Rabbi Gamliel Lo Hayu L'Meidin Torah Ela Me'umad. Now this can't be literal because the Gemara in Brachot that we just read actually describes not only Rabbi Gamliel but everybody else sitting. So I don't know. But it clearly is meaning something else. But it's saying representing a concept here. From Moshe until Rabbi Gamliel, they only learned Torah standing up. Mishemet Rabbi Gamliel, Yerad Choli La'olam. This is very explicit language the Gemara is using. There was a sickness that went into the world. The Hayu Lamedin Torah Miyushav. It was a sickness. Describing it as a sickness that people started learning Torah sitting down. The Hayinu Dutan, and this is what the Mishnah says. Mishemet Rabbi Gamliel, Batal Kavara Torah. So the Gemara, despite all of these stories, despite my silly childish impression that I'm sure many of us have had of who Rabbi Gamliel is after that story, the Gemara still acknowledges that as fiery of his personality as he may have been, he stood for something. He stood for Kavod HaTorah. And anybody who stands for Kavod HaTorah, regardless of the methods in which they employ, somebody who stands that sincerely, who believes that strongly about the importance and the primacy of Torah, that's somebody that is not... is not somebody to be criticized. That's somebody who needs to be remain a part of us. And we didn't read the rest of the Gemara, but the Gemara actually goes on to say that shortly after Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah took over, Rabbi Gamliel was contrite, and they brought him back in, and he retook his mantle of leadership. So I think if there's any, as is the case with any of these shirim, if there's anything that we can take from all of this, is that the debate and the discussion is complex. It's not a simple this is the way and this is that or that is the way. I think that understanding and appreciating the character of Rabbi Gamliel is a way to really typify and really to understand and appreciate the level and the depth of that debate, of that discussion, and it's for us to glean inspiration and appreciation from. Yishkoach.